Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up in the program, we'll be talking about how Massachusetts is considering a plan to host some of those tens of thousands of children who crossed illegally into the U.S. from Mexico. But first, iPhones, iMacs, Androids, tablets, all this technology has allowed us to do amazing things. They help us gather and organize information, learn about our world, from whether the Red Sox won last night to what form of government they have in Kazakhstan.
They can also help us keep track of our personal bank accounts and the national debt. But to David Rose, they're just distracting slabs of glass with limited powers. He envisions a better use of technology, a future where everyday objects, from umbrellas to trash cans to coffee tables, will be enlivened with the power of the Internet.
The guiding concept here is what's called the Internet of Things. It's a world of embedded technology that will give us enchanted objects. It already is. Smart things that will work better for us. David Rose is an entrepreneur and instructor at the MIT Media Lab, specializing in how digital information interfaces with the physical environment. He writes about his vision for the future and why it will succeed in his new book, Enchanted Objects, Design Human Desire and the Internet of Things. And he joins us now. And David Rose, great to have you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Thank you for coming in.
It's great to be here.
So let's talk about this. But before we get into to this sort of vision of enchanted objects, talk to me about these slabs of glass, because iPhones, iPads, Androids, sort of extraordinary machines, more powerful than the computers that once took up a full room at MIT, right? But what's wrong with a future of even more powerful touchscreens?
Yeah, I think most people assume that the future of the way that we interact with technology will be through these tablets and phablets and iPhones and app stores. And I think it's problematic because as attractive as they are to us, and almost seductive as they are to us, they really demand a lot of our attention. And in order to do anything with them, you have to tap on an icon, open an app. It takes seconds to do those things. Right. And there's the ability to embed information more seamlessly and calmly in our environment so that we can glance at information or interact with it in tangible ways, which are much more humanistic.
All right. And we're going to talk about that a lot in a moment. But there's another view of the future that you're equally less enthused about, and that's a world of increasingly sophisticated robots. So they're already assembling our cars, flying in the skies as drones, doing all kinds of things. So what's wrong with that vision where, you know, smart robots wandering around our house, taking care of our every whim and desire?
Right. So in the first part of the book, I talk about different places that we can locate technology.
Yeah.
You know, it either can be located in these black slabs of glass. It can be located on ourselves and in ourselves as sort of a digital prosthetic, or they can be outsourced, you know, outsourced to the robot slaves, if you will. And, you know, this is sort of what I think about as the Downton Abbey vision for the way we'd like to live. Like, we'd have different objects, that different robots, different personality, sort of animated people that are replicants in our lives that would help with one for language learning, one that would orchestrate how we get around in the world, one that would buy our groceries for us. And ultimately, I think the interface for these things, at least as it's been imagined in film and in science fiction, is increasingly humanoid. So
right.
We sort of want to make these things into ourselves, into replications of ourselves.
Right.
And that increasingly falls into what's called the uncanny valley, which is the better we are at creating these things that look human-like, the closer we get to human likeness, the more that they actually threaten our own humanity. They turn into golems or sort of zombies, and it's
so
not something.
So, is this sort of from the world of unintended consequences? I mean, we create—I don't know. Let's say we get Siri almost in the flesh to do things for us, and then she turns out to have a darker side that we didn't anticipate.
Yeah, and I think a much more positive vision for the way that we'd like to interact with technology is to have it really atomize and be embedded in the everyday things that we use and that we touch and we interact with every day. So we'd want it embedded in our clothing and in our umbrellas and in our tables and in our cabinetry and in our, all the fabric of our lives. And I think When that happens, the interaction can become incredibly simple, because each of these little pieces of technology can just do one extra thing for us, and we don't need an interface or to be threatened by someone who's trying to be a replicant.
And in many ways, you argue and point out, this is already beginning to happen, and we can talk about those enchanted objects that are sort of beginning to be all around us. But you have a sort of great vision for many more. And if I can, I want to read just a tiny piece from this New York Times piece yesterday that Penelope Green wrote about you.
Today.
Because it sort of brings to life who you are and also this argument. And she writes, "Mr. Rose has strewed his own household with so many enchanted objects that it resembles a contemporary version of the Burrow, the magical home of the Weasley family in the Harry Potter series. With talking pill bottles, a teleporting cabinet, open a door and it connects to Skype to Mr. Rose's parents in Wisconsin, and glowing orbs nestled among the design within reach furniture." So, nice description of your home. So, before we talk about some of those great examples of the enchanted objects, say more about the Internet of Things and the vision that it holds for our future.
Well, I think one of the hypotheses that I make in the book is that it's actually hard to come up with things that won't be connected to the internet. Mm. You know, it's like there are the cost of computing is falling, the cost of wireless, the ability to embed solar that will power or some other parasitic power. You know, there's a poster that goes along with the book that people can get on enchantedobjects.com.
It's right. Spread out in front of me, right. And we're going to be talking about what's on it. But
it sort of organizes all of these things into desires that we've had forever since the sort of revealed through fairy tales and science fiction, the desire to be all-knowing, the desire to connect with others seamlessly, the desires to feel like we're safe, the desires to have a long life, the desires to move effortlessly around the world, and the desire for personal expression, either through play or making things. And so one of the first projects that I was involved in, sort of before even the term of Internet of Things or Enchanted Objects came out, was a project for Lego called the Lego Mindstorms. And in each Lego brick, these little tiny plastic bricks, we embedded computation and connectivity and sensors. Mm. So you could make a robot that behaved as an invention. So instead of just a way of building what you imagine, you could actually make something behave in the way that you'd imagine. You could make a robot that wouldn't fall off a table because it has a long nose and it backs up if the nose is not over anything. And so I just thought, wow, if you can embed internet connectivity and sort of a sense of magic and a sense of behavior that you can program into a Lego brick, it can be everywhere.
So just to get down to a very small concrete example and just get back to Penelope Green's piece about your home, the glow cap. This is a talking pill bottle, essentially, right?
Well,
how does that work?
Yeah, I mean, it talks in the sense that it talks wireless through AT&T's network to the cloud. But because it fits on an ordinary amber vial, it can really subtly prompt you to take your medication on a regular basis, which is a huge issue in this country, as you may know. Mm-hmm. And so this is just an internet-connected pill bottle cap, and it tries to be as subtle as possible, as I said. So it starts off with just a really subtle pulsing light, and then if you still haven't taken your med after a couple of hours, it makes cute little arpeggio ringtones, do-do-do-do-do, like sort of a singer's warm-up, do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And then after even more time, it may text you, or it may eventually call your home phone. If you've had a transplant and you really need to take your immunosuppressant, for example, it's really critical, then you really want this to be insistent, not just subtle and subconscious. But for these devices, you know, as Penelope talks about, there are hundreds of them in our homes, and they all need to have really a respect for your own attention, and they all have to go to finishing school so that they're, you know, talking to each other and sort of working together on your behalf. Mm. And so this connected pill bottle helps me take my medication, you know, over 90% of the time, and others too. It's called a glow cap.
So talk about some of these other enchanted objects. This is in this great cardboard, this great big piece of paper that sort of organized this. One that jumped out on me, and again, that Penelope Green mentioned, the Skype cabinet, what she called the teleporting cabinet. But basically, it's a Skype cabinet in your house.
Yeah, that's right. It's sort of like the dedicated red phone to Gorbachev, except in this case, it connects a six-year-old boy to his grandparents. And, you know, I'm happy to have my son talk to his grandparents as much as they're both willing to chat with each other. And I want to make that communication as seamless and as, you know, high verisimilitude as possible. So they both simply open a door and there they are. So the cabinet knows that they're nearby because it has a proximity sensor and it sort of glows when each other is nearby. And then it's just a dedicated connection. And, you know, he's not actually interested in talking to that many other people, and neither are they. And so having sort of makes sense to embed these connections into furniture or into the kitchen where they have theirs in a way that can allow them to talk much more frequently and much more sort of serendipitously and for, you know, shorter time periods, but it's nothing that I have to orchestrate.
There are really some wonderful examples in here. You write about, and I think you have this in your house as well, a door buzzer that not only will tell you that someone's at the door, but it will actually tell you that someone you know is approaching your house, right? Do I have that right?
Yeah, it was really designed for the sort of end of the day coordination. You want to know who's on their way home and how soon will they be arriving. So this was inspired by a record that my parents used to play from Prokofiev, Peter and the Wolf, where essentially every character in Peter and the Wolf has a ringtone. So the hunters are bum bum bum. Or I forgot exactly the hunters.
I know you.
I thought that was
going
to work.
You were going with that.
It's a French horn. It's dun 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 dun.
There, you got it.
And so as people are on their homeward bound, it uses their location, which is given by Google Latitude, to basically trigger a subtle ringtone for that family member that plays on this doorbell. So it's sort of gets you a sense of how soon someone will be home and sort of the pace of their homecoming. And it's calming to know that they're on their way. And for me, this is a sort of key point, which is you might want to map that information of location onto a map. Mm-hmm. But a map is way too intrusive, right? Your friends don't want to be tracked on a map all the time. But if you just take the information and abstract it a little bit and make it ambient, in this case, it's a sound-only interface, then you get this nice sort of breeze of presence idea that's really useful and nice to have around, and it doesn't require another screen in the house, and it's not sort of overwrought with specificity, which is, I think, is a problem of a lot of the apps that we have today.
Listeners, we're talking to David Rose. He's author of Enchanted Objects, Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. What kinds of technology do you want in your future? We want to hear from you on this. Do you believe in the power and the potential of the Internet of Things, as David Rose is describing it? What's the downside when so many everyday objects are collecting data about you and your world? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And David, let me ask you about that concern that, I love this and I love talking about these objects and I love what you've written, but I mentioned sort of the potential downside, at least sort of something that kind of creeps me out a little bit when I think way into the future about that stuff. And that is, for every one of these sort of ingenious objects with embedded technology that can collect data and give and spit data out, it's produced by a company that can have access to that data too. And there's been a lot of concern about sort of what the government is doing with all this information and spying on us and so forth. Does the Internet of Things raise big privacy questions?
I think it raises many big privacy questions. It certainly creates this huge sort of data explosion in the amount of bits that are coming out of your house. Mm-hmm. And I think those have the power for good and also the power for some complicated consequences. I think all of these things have to be opt-out. I mean, for the GloCap, for example, people can choose to share the information with a weekly email with their loved one. So I do this with my father. So I want to see how he's doing on his meds, and I'm willing to trade him that information about my medication taking. You can also opt in to have your doctor see if you've taken your medication. So if your blood pressure is still high and you've been taking your medication, maybe you need a different blood pressure med. And you can also opt in to having the pharmacy know that you need a refill. But if you're not comfortable with any of those streams of information, you can turn them all off.
You can turn them off.
Right.
All right. So I want to, there's just so many that are intriguing here. Tell me about the proverbial wallet.
Oh, this was a prototype that was done for Bank of America. I think the problem that they saw was people are using plastic rampantly, credit cards rampantly, without any sense of whether you're blowing through your budget for the month. And so this is an ordinary leather wallet that has a variable resistance hinge, and it talks to the cloud. So as you get closer and closer to your budget limit for the month, it becomes harder and harder to open the wallet, and you get a sense, you get this tangible sense of maybe you shouldn't be spending money as quickly as you were expected to. Mm. And what I love about this object is that there's no screen in sight. Right, it's using this sense of touch and of resistance, of haptic feedback, in order to communicate, and it probably acts even on a sort of semi-conscious level, right? As you reach into your wallet and you grab this thing, you know, it's feedback that is so subtle because it's embedded in an ordinary gesture and in an ordinary object, and so it doesn't increase your cognitive load of having to like open an app and think about it and, you know, access information. And I would hope that more interfaces have that sort of tangibility and subtlety and embeddedness in our lives.
Let's take a couple of calls. We've got a bunch of people who want to get in on this conversation. Bruce is calling from Concord. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air with David Rose.
Gentlemen, good afternoon. Fascinating topic. And you mentioned something that caught my ear, and that is medication caps on medication, and the application of technology to such a cap, in which you might be able to communicate when to take that medication, but more importantly, what the medication is, when it's scheduled to be taken, and what have you. I come from the data center industry. We deploy an awful lot of in terms of asset tracking and security measures, we deploy an awful lot of RFID. This is RFID technology. This is an embedded sensor which gets applied to each asset in a data center. And that small RFID, albeit active or passive, can tell you everything down to the manufacturer of the component, when it was bought, where it was installed, when it's going to be when it's decided to be maintenanced. So my point for calling is simply, how do we get technology, more advanced technology, such as wireless technology, coupled with a very common technology like RFID?
All right, Bruce, let's get David Rose to respond to that. First of all, Bruce, maybe you can sort of sum up what RFID is.
Well, it's short for radio frequency identification, and it the sort of promise of RFID is that for very, very low cost, like less than a penny, you can tag things with a unique identifier, and then that tag can be read. So embedded in a credit card or a Charlie card or a pill bottle, you could very, very inexpensively tag things and then sort of know what's walking out of the store or know who's walking into the subway.
I see.
It's another component and, you know, critical piece of the infrastructure of how these Internet of Things will be sensed. And today it's deployed, I think, mostly for tracking expensive things that are on their way, you know, across seas for the military or on their way out of Walmart. And it's been used mostly for tracking and not for sort of changing the user experience of how people interact with things in the home, simply because the readers haven't been long range enough and are typically more expensive.
I see. Let's take another call. Amir is calling from Cambridge. Amir, you're on the air. Good to have you.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is has to do basically with this idea of polling our devices versus being interrupted by them. And I can see how for some things it would be really critical that we be interrupted, for example, to take our medications. But if everything is interrupting us with these little signals about when people are around or nearby or whatever. I wonder if we're not likely just to tune out all the noise, and how sort of we balance, or how, you know, one would balance important messages and less important messages. And I just want to get your thoughts on that.
It's a good one. It sounds like what Amir is getting to is, you know, could the sort of enchanted object, the Internet of Things, make us almost overconnected, overwhelmed with all this connectivity?
Yeah, I think one of the important design principles that I talk about in the book is designing for subtlety. Mm. And so there's a diagram in the book that talks about cues that are pre-conscious versus cues that are ambient, sort of barely aware, barely, you know, subtle and glanceable versus apparent versus intrusive. And it's interesting how much design space there is in the pre-conscious category. So, for example, subtle scent or ambient temperature shifting or subliminal sound effects. Like, these are cues that we are semi-conscious of. You know, you walk into a nice hotel and you say, wow, it looks beautiful in here. And really what your brain is responding to is maybe a scent, not actually the decor. And so, you know, our brain tends to conflate some of these signals. But I think the key idea for designers of internet-connected things is that they have to absolutely respect our attention. They shouldn't use sound or especially beeping as the first thing, the way that they communicate with us. You know, I would love to work with a kitchen appliance maker, and the first thing I would do would be to take all of the beeping out of microwaves and stoves and signaling and try to make those more subtle, calmer sound effects.
Well, I want to get at least a couple more callers in this conversation, but give me another example of what we're talking about. Tell us about the ambient umbrella.
Well, the ambient umbrella was inspired by the ambient orb. The orb is a sort of crystal ball that can, where the color can shift to represent any information you want, whether it's pollen count or wind speed or your book's position on the bestseller list or, mm-hmm. you know, anything you care about. And we started tracking one of the most popular things that we tracked at Ambient Devices with the orb, in addition to the price of energy for doing demand management for energy companies, was the weather. So the color was mapped to the temperature, and it would subtly pulse if there was rain due. And, you know, it was a beautiful object, and people loved it, but it didn't really communicate its purpose. And so we thought, well, why don't we embed that LED and that connectivity to AccuWeather into an object that would communicate its purpose? And so, inspired by Frodo, who was given, I think it's an elvish sword that glows when orcs are nearby. So it's it's an object that anticipates its own use. We thought, well, the perfect place to embed this information about the rain is in the object that you need to act on when rain is due. And so it sort of locates the information in that decisional moment, you know, not before you need to think about the umbrella and not after you need to think about, but exactly when you need to pick it up. And so I think that's another recipe for calm, is to not tell people information before they can act on it. So it's sort of positioning the information right in that critical moment.
Well, I wish we had more time, David Rose. This is such a fascinating conversation. We've still got lots of listeners who would like to get in on this conversation. I'm just going to wrap it up with this question. You know, there's still a lot of research invested in smartphones and in robotics and prosthetics. These technologies don't seem like they're going away. So why do you have so much faith that, you know, people are going to see the light and start looking seriously at this future of enchanted objects? You have so much faith in this vision for the future.
Well, I think there's a profound shift in what's possible now, and what will drive the change is frankly the economics of, there are a lot of companies that make inert stuff in the world. Like, just think about an old category like luggage. You know, if you're Samsonite or Tumi, like, you're dying for some sort of differentiation, and you're finding that today with, like, rolling. But now everything rolls, you know? And so now there's a potential for, like, less than a couple of dollars to embed a little radio in a Tumi piece of luggage that can tell you that your baggage is almost there. Like, in a $300 piece of luggage, that's almost a no-brainer. So it's going to be it's going to be the companies that make products today that want to turn those into services and experiences that are going to drive the industry.
Well, it's a fascinating world to imagine. David Rose, he's an instructor, entrepreneur, instructor at the MIT Media Lab. His new book is called Enchanted Objects, Design, Human Desire, and the Internet of Things. David Rose, thank you so much for coming in.
I've enjoyed it, Anthony. Thanks.
And listeners, stay with us, please. We're going to be talking about Governor Patrick's consideration of a plan to host some of those children who crossed illegally into the U.S. from Mexico. That's coming up soon. I'm Anthony Brooks with Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.